From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actress Jennifer Jason Leigh. She often plays women on the edge, a psychotic roommate in Single White Female, and a punk rocker with a drug habit in Georgia. Now she's starring in two literary adaptations, 1,000 Acres, based on the Jane Smiley novel, and Washington Square, based on the Henry James novella. Also, renowned French chef Georges Perrier no longer eats the classic butter and cream sauces he used to prepare, but he still loves to prepare fresh pigeon. We'll talk with the founder of the Philadelphia restaurant Le Bec Fin about his first cookbook. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Three people have been arrested and charged with spying during the Cold War for East Germany, the Soviet Union, and South Africa. One of the suspects was, until early this year, a senior staff attorney for a deputy secretary of defense. The Swedish Academy has given the Nobel Prize in Medicine to Dr. Stanley Prusiner, lauded for his discovery of prions. These are described as a brand new type of disease-causing agents. The finding could shed light on Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Zach Hall directs the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke. He says Prusiner's work has many applications to illnesses being treated today.
It's very relevant now because of the mad cow disease in Britain, which is thought to be transmitted from cows to humans. And the mechanism of transmission is precisely according to the route which Stan Prusiner proposed for these slow virus diseases.
The Nobel Peace Prize winner will be announced this Friday. Senate investigators are expected to hear from former White House Deputy Chief of Staff Harold Ickes this week. Ickes played a crucial role in President Clinton's fundraising strategy in 1995 and 1996. NPR's Chittaraghavan reports.
Despite the key role he played in Democratic fundraising, Ickes has not been asked to testify before now. He has been deposed twice. He'll face many questions about White House fundraising telephone calls made by President Clinton and Vice President Gore. Attorney General Janet Reno is looking into 46 phone calls Gore says he made to donors from his office. President Clinton says he can't remember, but he may have made some calls as well. The President and Vice President have both said that if they did make any calls, they were perfectly legal. In his deposition last month, Ickes said that he did not play a role in arranging the phone calls. Ickes also will be asked if he tried to act as a go-between for administration officials and potential Democratic contributors. I'm Chitraragavan, NPR News, Washington.
There's a new problem aboard the Russian space station Mir. As Alistair Wanklin reports, a cargo module has failed to undock from Mir.
Russian space officials say some of the locks that hold the unmanned Progress M35 module to Mir refused to respond on command from mission control. The Progress module is full of garbage and was meant to fall away and burn up in the Earth's atmosphere, leaving the docking port free for a supply craft that's currently on its way to Mir. Ground controllers say they will try to force the Progress module to detach again when Mir swings into radio contact. They have 24 hours before the new supply craft reaches Mir, carrying two tons of fuel, water, and oxygen for the three men aboard, including new arrival American David Wolf. For NPR News, I'm Alistair Wanklin in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up 41 points at 8,080. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher thanks to a drop in long-term interest rates. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner has more.
The market is reevaluating the political and military situation in the Persian Gulf, which last week pushed the price of crude oil 10% higher. However, crude has fallen today, and investors are now focusing on the fundamentals of the U.S. economy, like the report on September employment, which argued in favor of stable interest rates. Today's gains are being limited, though, by concern about earnings. Silicon Graphics has lost more than 30% after the company said it expects a fiscal first quarter loss because of weak sales of computer network servers. And shares in La Quinta Inns are lower after the company warned of disappointing results. I'm Doug Krisner.
The White House says President Clinton will use the line item veto in a $9 billion military construction bill. He'll eliminate 38 projects worth $287 million. When exercised, this will be the second time Mr. Clinton has used the line item veto. He is the first president ever to have this authority. The president is said to have used three criteria in vetoing the projects. They were not in his original request, no design work had been done on them, or these did not contribute to the well-being of military personnel. The Supreme Court has opened a new term today by hearing a case pitting banks against credit unions. Credit unions were allowed to expand several years ago by inviting outsiders to join. Banks say that's unfair competition. Other issues before the high court this term include affirmative action and sexual harassment, along with televised political debates, lie detector tests, and police car crashes. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach, with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jennifer Jason Leigh is known for portraying over-the-edge characters. A prostitute in Last Exit to Brooklyn, a psychopathic killer roommate in Single White Female, a heroin-addicted punk rocker in Georgia. She's won the Best Actress Award from the National Society of Film Critics and the New York Film Critics Circle. Now she's starring in two literary adaptations. She plays one of the three sisters in 1,000 Acres, based on Jane Smiley's novel, which is a contemporary reworking of King Lear. And Leigh is starring in a new adaptation of the Henry James novella, Washington Square. Written in 1880 and set in New York, it's the story of a shy, plain, and not terribly interesting young woman, Catherine, who is the heir to a fortune. When a handsome, young, but broke suitor asks to marry her, she believes she's found her true love, but her father is convinced it's the money the young man is after. The father, portrayed in the film by Albert Finney, forces his daughter to choose between him and the young man, and between money and love. Washington Square was also the basis of the 1949 film The Heiress, which starred Olivia de Havilland and Montgomery Clift. I asked Jennifer Jason Leigh if there were lines in the Henry James novella that were particularly helpful in developing her character. She read me a passage.
"And if the delightful custom of her lover's visage, which yielded her a happiness in which confidence and timidity were strangely blended, had suddenly come to an end, she would not only not have spoken of herself as one of the forsaken, but she would not have thought of herself as one of the disappointed."
I think one of the things that's really key in that line is her blend of confidence and timidity.
Mm-hmm, exactly, and the confidence that it slowly comes to her, because this is someone who had no confidence, and once in love, she's able to bloom and find herself, and once in love, when she looks in the mirror, she doesn't see this ugly creature any longer who's always disappointing. She sees herself anew, as it were. And as you do when you fall in love, suddenly there is ground under your feet, and it's just the most beautiful feeling in the world. And with Catherine, the way that James describes her, she always thought it would be this passionate, quick feeling of constant energy, and yet what he writes when she's in love is that it gives her all the patience in the world, because suddenly she's fulfilled in a way that is almost includes a kind of sacrifice, because she can live from day to day or week to month just on the one visit and the knowledge that he said, "I will see you again." And I think I was certainly like that. And I know a lot of women who were. I mean, I remember the first crush I had, and I couldn't even call that love, but it was with I was 16, and it was with a waiter, and he would say things like, "Take it easy," and I would think about it for hours, you know, really, or "See you later," and just the fact that there was hope in that, you know, that he might actually want to see me later. You could live on things like that, so I certainly understand. I mean, James just writes it in a much more beautiful way, but the feelings are timeless.
Had he singled you out at a table he was waiting on?
Oh, me and my girlfriends would just go and sit at his table for hours, night after night. We were, you know, like silly girls. And he was the man.
Now, let me get back to Henry James. A couple of other descriptions that I'd like to read from the book. And this is her father, the character's father, thinking about her. He thinks, poor Catherine was not defiant. She had no genius for bravado. And later on, James describes her as, you know, a dull, plain girl, she was called by rigorous critics, a quiet, ladylike girl by those of the more imaginative sort. But by neither class was she very elaborately discussed. So here's somebody who starts off kind of invisible, kind of unable to assert herself into the world in any way. And later she gets the kind of strength that is, in a way, also invisible. You know, it's such a kind of quiet,
it's a quiet
hidden
strength.
So tell me about playing all these traits that are so hidden.
Well, in a sense, that was the easy part, because that's the part I understand. That's the part that's closest to home. And for me, in playing Catherine, those were the qualities which I really do understand, because I possess them. I am quiet by nature. I am shy by nature. I am socially awkward. And it's hard for me to articulate what I feel and to express myself in a way that feels natural. And so I loved her journey in this and her arc, because what happens is she comes to accept her awkwardness, as it were, and her silence, and accept them as her strengths. And so that's nice.
This is a period piece. You're wearing period clothes, 19th century, set in New York. And let me read again something from Henry James. And this is him describing her sense of clothing, her sense of style. He writes, our heroine was 20 years old before she treated herself for evening wear to a red satin gown trimmed with gold fringe, though this was an article which for many years she had coveted in secret. It made her look, when she sported it, like a woman of 30, but oddly enough, in spite of her taste for fine clothes, she had not a grain of coquetry, and her anxiety when she put them on was as to whether they, and not she, would look well. Tell me how you wore these clothes and what you tried to convey in them.
Well, being an inarticulate girl, I think she uses clothes as a means to express herself. And she has so much to say, and she wants to say it in the most grand, beautiful, expressive way. And of course she chooses everything wrong, I mean, but it's her way of communicating something. The clothes were incredibly awkward, and the corsets were extremely uncomfortable.
Did you have to wear corsets for the role?
Absolutely, yeah. The clothes won't fit without the corsets. And the thing of it is, I also, of course, did a lot of research about corsetry and the medical journals about the dangers of too tight lacing. And it's pretty fascinating. I mean, what it does is they put the waist at your floating rib, which, you know, they made my waist to 19 inches, and so everything is compressed, and all your internal organs are pushed down. And some of these women, their livers would be pushed so far back that they would have the impression of the stays in them. Women wore organ stoppers, which looked like diaphragms, because sometimes their organs would come out of their bodies. They would die from having their lungs punctured by their ribs. The ribs would grow extra cartilage and become connected to the breastbone. So, I mean, you can only imagine what life was like back then. And when you also think that you couldn't dress yourself as a woman if you had money, because all your dresses laced in the back and buttoned in the back. And when you think about that for even a short period of time, you realize how just how imprisoned you would feel in your life, in everyday life, not being able to simply dress yourself. No freedom, no independence whatsoever.
Because this is set in 19th century New York, were there certain contemporary mannerisms that you had to get rid of? Mannerisms of your own that you really had to banish because they were just so inappropriate for the period?
Well, there were a lot of, I found a lot of etiquette books on the period, which were very, very helpful to me. Most of the mannerisms that I had to get rid of were speech mannerisms. So I worked with a dialect coach. And we actually all had to work with a dialect coach, because Judith Ivey and I, we were the only Americans in the cast, but we were all supposed to be American. So, but, you know, in the 1850s, the speech was more mid-Atlantic, they call it. So we all sort of worked together on that. And, yeah, you know, women weren't supposed to express their emotions. That wasn't correct behavior, so to speak, you know. You weren't supposed to touch your face very often. But Catherine fails at all these things because she's without artifice. I really loved learning the etiquette, the language of the glove, of the fan, of the parasol, which can be quite confusing because they all, you know, one book defines it one way, another book defines it another way.
Jennifer Jason Leigh is my guest, and she's starring in the new film adaptation of the Henry James novella Washington Square. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Jennifer Jason Leigh. She's starring in a film adaptation of the Henry James novella Washington Square. And she also stars in the adaptation of Jane Smiley's novel, A Thousand Acres. Let me ask you about A Thousand Acres. Like Washington Square, it's based on a book. So this is like two movies in a row where you had to, you know, go through the book as well as the screenplay. So has that opened up a new dimension to you? I mean, to have so much book to fall back on. I mean, to
yeah, it's lovely. Yeah. It helps a lot because you don't have to invent as much. There's so much of the inner life of the character right there for you to read and to understand, and you know. They're great writers, so it's a pleasure also to read. And when I was doing A Thousand Acres, I went on kind of a Jane Smiley binge.
Right.
And read everything, I think. So that was a lot of fun.
Now, in A Thousand Acres, Jason Robards plays your father. And I know that he was a longtime friend of the family's. In fact, when you took a stage name, the Jennifer Jason Leigh. The Jason is from Jason Robards.
Yeah. So it was great working with him.
Well,
and
I was really wondering about that, though, because I know, let me tell you that when I find it very difficult sometimes to interview somebody I know well, to interview a friend. And I was wondering if there was any kind of similar difficulty you felt acting with somebody who you know really well and who you're really close with.
You know, it's not, it's almost the opposite because the more comfortable you are with someone, the easier acting with them is, I think. And also, it was very easy for me to believe Jason was my dad because I think of him in such a paternal way.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always admired him so much and just felt so much love for him that it was great to pretend to be his daughter for a little while. You know, he's a great man and, you know, obviously a great actor. And, yeah, I just love him, and I am so happy that I got to work with him.
You know, it seems to me that in spite of now playing the very kind of subtle characters that Jane Smiley and Henry James have written, that in a lot of ways you've really specialized in extremes, in playing prostitutes and punk rockers and people who are really on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And even in Washington Square, it's an extreme. It's an extremely inhibited character.
Right.
And I'm wondering why you gravitate to extremes.
I think because, in a very simple way, they're just the most exciting characters to play. And they're the most challenging and the farthest reaching, really. And you're communicating something that is outside most people's experience and yet trying to illuminate that person. And sometimes it's a person that we might not otherwise really take more than a, you know, casual glance at and then be thankful we're not that person. So it's a way of... none of their characters that I find moving for whatever reason.
You said that growing up, you were the good girl. It was your sister who was the extrovert, the one kicked out of school, the one who joined the carnival, the one who had a drug habit for a few years. Are there characters you understood through knowing your sister?
I think so, and I think it was also a way to understand my sister.
Mm-hmm. By kind of playing her out in these roles?
Mm-hmm, exactly. And a way of trying to understand and get closer to her, because in playing a lot of them, I would call her up. And so adults, that's almost how we became friends again. And there was always something, a little bit of, in a strange way, hero worship with my sister, even though, you know, she was sort of the black sheep and getting into trouble left and right. But I admired her courage, I think, even though I don't think it was the healthiest existence. I admired her daring to go and live out where most of us never would dare to go or want to go.
So she lived on the edge through her actions, and you lived on the edge through your acting.
Yeah. I lived on the edge in a very safe way.
You know, in the movie Georgia, the movie was written by your mother. Yeah. And was about two sisters. One sister is a very sensitive folk rock singer. You played the sister who was the punk rocker, the sister who was on the edge, the sister who developed a drug habit. You played someone who is passionate about singing but doesn't have an inherently beautiful voice.
Mm-hmm.
What she does have is a lot of attitude and a lot of passion on stage. How did you handle the singing part so that you would get all that across?
Well, I love to sing, but I wasn't gifted. You know, I wasn't blessed with a very good voice at all. And so it wasn't so hard. I just sang out, Louise, and I had a great time. I must say, just to be that free and that alive and that out there, and not to care what you sounded like, but to be... Sadie is so in love with singing and so in love with being in front of an audience and exposing herself, really. 'Cause when she sings, she's very naked and it's very raw. And so it was... I mean, it was scary, but it was thrilling at the same time. So, and I didn't have to worry about trying to sing badly or trying to sing well. It was just about the experience of singing, you know?
Of really being out there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me play your performance from the movie of a Van Morrison song. And this is just a real showpiece in the movie, because you're so on the edge with this. So let's hear some.
Okay. I've been walking by. I've been walking down by the water. I've been walking down by the river.
This must have been so out there for you, because you always describe yourself as in reality being a very inhibited person.
Yeah, but that's why I love acting. So when I was playing Sadie, I had the time of my life, really. Mm. I mean, that night was scary, and for a number of reasons. There were 3,000 people there. It's definitely the biggest night of Sadie's life, and it would be also one of the biggest nights of my life. We had, you know, we didn't have any money making that film, so the way we got people there was by getting local bands to play, and then we'd shoot in between the local bands. There was so much adrenaline pumping through my body that, I mean, for days afterwards, I just felt exhausted, like a zombie. All of us, I think, actually, because it was, there was a lot of pressure to get it all done in one night, and then it's Sadie's trying to, you know, pay homage to Van Morrison, so I really wanted to get every nuance down. But the thing about Sadie is the more she tries to be someone else, the more Sadie she becomes, and the
right.
more Sadie comes through. And so, I mean, I when I was doing it, I thought I was Van Morrison, and then I heard it back, and no, it was Sadie.
You said something that I think is so true about this character you wrote. There's always been something beautiful to you about someone who dreams about something, desperately wants it, but has no talent for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like how this character desperately wants to be a great singer, but isn't, you know, inherently blessed with what we'd consider a beautiful voice. Although, again, you know, she just has this stage presence. But how did you understand that? Because, I mean, you have the gift for acting. Is there something you've desperately wanted to do but felt untalented enough to do well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so many things. For example, well, singing is an example. Everyone in my family has a very, very beautiful voice. In fact, Carrie, my older sister, who has a lot of elements of Sadie, has a voice like Joplin, seriously like Joplin. And it's a powerhouse, and it's beautiful and amazing to listen to. My little sister, Mina, has an incredibly beautiful, melodic, full voice. My mom has a great voice, everyone. And I have this weak, tinny, you know, nothing voice. And then, but I like to sing really loud, and then it just sounds horrible. So, yeah, I mean, that's certainly one thing. And, of course, when I see it in people who have a love of something that they have no talent for, but they've decided to make that their profession, then that's really sad to me, and really beautiful, though, the yearning for that. And I think that's something that we all, I think, can understand to a degree, because we all have that in us. I mean, when we read a beautiful poem or hear a piece of music, and we just, you know, it makes you think there is God, that God touched this person, and how grateful you are to be able to hear it, but the yearning and the knowledge that you could never produce that, I think is something we all can understand.
Jennifer Jason Leigh will be back in the second half of the show. She's starring in Washington Square and The Thousand Acres. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jennifer Jason Leigh describes some of the horrible ways she's been killed and mutilated in B-movies. And lighter French cooking. We talk with French chef Georges Perrier of the renowned Le Becfin restaurant. He has a new cookbook.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jennifer Jason Leigh. She's now starring in 1,000 Acres, based on the Jane Smiley novel, and Washington Square, based on the Henry James novella. Her mother, Barbara Turner, is a screenwriter. She wrote the screenplay for Georgia, in which Jennifer Jason Leigh played a punk rocker with more passion than talent. When you were a girl, how much did you get to see of your mother's screenwriting career?
Oh, everything. I mean, when I was very, very young, I was reading her screenplays, which made me feel proud, I think. The fact that she would let me read them and then she would actually say, "What do you think?" So from a very young age, I felt that my thoughts or my ideas about things had some validity or there was a place for them to be heard.
I know you don't like to talk about your father, but I just have one question. Your father was the actor Vic Morrow, and I know your parents were separated when you were 2. And I'm wondering what it was like to know him maybe primarily through television. I don't know if Combat was on when you were young, if you saw reruns of it, but it must have been unusual to see your father through roles and not have a lot of contact with him in life.
Well, Combat was actually when I was very, very young. So I do have memories, even though I was 2, of watching Combat and absolutely loving it. I have a bunch of those on tape, actually. My favorite movie was Blackboard Jungle that he made, and that was made before I was born. So, but, you know, I knew my father growing up. It wasn't as though I didn't know him.
Uh-huh. You dropped out of high school about 6 weeks before graduation to take
right.
an acting role. What was the role and why were you willing to drop out for it?
I was, like, desperate for any reason to drop out of high school, actually.
Did you hate it?
I did.
For social reasons or for more
no,
academic
I
reasons?
No, I had great, great friends. I mean, great friends who are still my great friends. I mean, I have friends from 2 because I grew up in L.A. And a lot of them had, we had all gone to Oakwood, which is a small, private, very liberal school in Los Angeles. And then they suddenly, in 10th grade, decided to go to a public school in the Palisades. I didn't live in the Palisades, so I became an emancipated minor and used a false address so that I could go to school just to be with my friends, which basically meant being an emancipated minor that I could write my own notes. And so I frequently went to school, met my friends, and then went to Westwood, which was the place where all the movie theaters were, and went to movies all day. So I didn't really go to school a lot in 11th and 12th grade. And I wanted to act. That's all I wanted to do, really. And I was, you know, bored and restless and just not really inspired. But unfortunately, there are things I regret about, not really about leaving high school. I only had 6 weeks left, and I still didn't know anything about American government. But the great thing about acting for me is that I do so much research, and so every time I have a role, I learn so much about subjects I had no knowledge about
right.
before.
I think in some ways your acting school was the early horror movies that that you made.
Yeah, the first movie was a B-horror film where I played a blind, deaf, and dumb girl who is hysterically blind, deaf, and dumb. Because of a rape when she was a child, and then there's an attempted rape at the end of the movie, and she gets all her senses back. So,
What are some of the various ways you've been killed or mutilated in movies over the years?
Gosh, I don't think I've been killed that many times, actually. I think just,
Last Exit to Brooklyn?
Oh, no, she doesn't die.
You don't think she dies in that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, she doesn't, I don't think so. I don't think she dies in the book. You just sort of leave her in a bloody mess, but I don't think
after
she
being
dies.
Gang raped and
gang banged, yeah,
yeah. And then in the Hitcher, dismembered
definitely.
By trucks. Your limbs are tied to trucks heading in opposite directions. This was. Were you ever actually tied to the trucks?
I was, but the trucks didn't move. They said the trucks were just going to move 2 inches, and did I want to try it first, or did I want to see the stunt double try it first? And I'm kind of safety conscious, and so I asked to see the stunt double try it first, and the trucks moved about 3 feet because they're very heavy trucks, and you can't really control how little they move. And so, you know, she was a very sturdy girl. Thank God. But it was a little frightening to watch.
In another horror film, or thriller, I should say, that you made, Single White Female.
I died in that.
Yeah, you died in that one, too. Right. Though it took a really long time to kill you.
<That's>
you
right.
kept coming back for more in that thriller kind of way. You play a character who answers a personal ad for a roommate. And your roommate is played by Bridget Fonda. So you move in with Bridget Fonda and then obsessively try to become her in every way, to get her hairdo and her manner and her clothes. And it's clear that you are, you know, something of a psychopath in it. And, mm-hmm. and then you become murderous. It must really be interesting to take on the traits of the character, you know, of the actress who you're playing opposite. Basically, to become Bridget Fonda in it. And I thought you were very convincing in doing that.
Oh, thanks. That was a really fun part. I mean, it was just so... I mean, psychologically, it was just very, very interesting, just the desire to merge. I mean, it really is a kind of merging, and the feeling that without the other, you are not whole. And so I did a lot of just research into borderline personality. And I was able to interview some twins who had been hospitalized for that, exactly. And it really is this feeling that someone else is responsible for your happiness. And so, therefore, you know, there's just the qualities of envy and all of that, that come into play, where this person is responsible for your happiness, therefore they can take it away, and that can be very threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not only that she wants to be like Bridget's character, she wants them to merge and be one.
Right.
And so at a certain point, she feels she's more her than Bridget's character, you know, in a certain way, that she has become her and they are one, but she definitely can't live without the other.
Do you think that your mother taught you how to read between the lines in a screenplay?
Well, I think what was great about having a mother that is a writer is, first of all, she's incredibly dedicated to her work, and she just, I think, for a woman, a girl growing up, seeing your mother working and seeing her in love with what she does and working sometimes 18, 20-hour days and having a tremendous passion about what she does and fighting for what she believes in and being absolutely uncompromising. And that's where I learned research from. I mean, she makes my research look like it's nothing. She's practically fanatical about it. And I feel really fortunate for that. It just showed me that women, I mean, I never thought there was an inequality between men and women, because my mother worked, and she worked really, really hard, and she was great at what she did. And it also spoiled me in terms of reading screenplays, because she's a great writer. And I, I love reading her scripts so much. And so I got, that kind of spoiled me because a lot of scripts aren't very good, you know.
Right. What are you working on now? What's your next movie?
I'm going to go work with David Cronenberg,
who
I've always wanted to work with.
Oh, great.
So I'm so excited.
What's the movie?
It's called Existenz.
As in existential?
Sort of.
Well, he's a great director, so that should be very interesting.
Yeah, he is great.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Jennifer Jason Leigh is starring in Washington Square and 1,000 Acres. Coming up, French chef Georges Perrier. This is Fresh Air. Georges Perrier founded one of the most highly regarded French restaurants in the U.S., Le Bec Fin, in Philadelphia. In fact, it's been named the number one restaurant in the U.S. by the Condé Nast Traveler's Reader's Poll. Now Perrier has written his first cookbook. Perrier grew up in France and was trained there in classic French cooking. He says most chefs in France come from restaurateur families. Eventually, they take over their family businesses. But he didn't come from such a family. His father was a jeweler, his mother a doctor. 30 years ago, when he was in his early 20s, he moved to the U.S. to help an American friend start a restaurant in Philadelphia. After 3 years at his friend's restaurant, Perrier opened Le Bec Fin. When Perrier decided to come to the U.S., friends in France warned him he'd never be able to find fresh greens, meat, and poultry here. I asked him if they were right.
When I first came to the States, it's true, we couldn't get foie gras, we couldn't get the herbs, we couldn't get this, we couldn't get that. But, you know, I mean, what I was not able to do, I talk about it, and I have a lady from the main line who grew up the herbs for me, I have somebody who grew up this for me, and I was able, you know, the change in this country on the past 30 years, I mean, Terry, if I remember what we used to be able to get 30 years ago and what we're getting now, now it's better than France.
Really? Is it better than France?
Yes.
How is it better?
I think the produce are better.
Produce?
I think so. I just came back from a trip to France. And I look at the food in France. The food is, it was really poor and bad. And I'm looking at the produce that we have in France. You know, sometimes the haricot vert in France because we have the haricot vert from Kenya. But here I have my haricot vert in the summer. My grower grew up haricot vert. It has nice, it's much more beautiful than what we get in France. So, you know, I mean, if somebody now who comes to the States and say to me, I cannot cook because I cannot get the produce, is a liar. You can get everything, maybe better than what you get in France.
One of the things that upset you when you came to the United States is that you couldn't get fresh pigeon. Now, when
did
I...
Did you weigh that?
Yeah, this is hard for me to understand because I think of pigeon as being those really dirty birds that fly around public parks and defecate in all the wrong places. I mean, to a lot of us, pigeons are kind of like flying rats. I've never tasted pigeon, but obviously it's a delicacy.
Yes, a delicacy. They're so good. I mean, I'm not talking about the pigeon fly on the street of Philadelphia. You certainly don't want to eat those pigeons.
Tell me what pigeon tastes like.
What pigeon tastes like? Pigeon tastes like... how can I describe pigeon? That certainly doesn't taste like a chicken. Pigeon, it's a very... You know what I like pigeon? Because it's a dark meat. And it tastes like a fowl. It's a mixture between, I will say, a partridge. And partridge has more flavor than the pigeon. But it's a little wild, so that's what I like, the wild aspect of the pigeon and the flavor comes from the meat. And, you know, I like my pigeon medium rare when it's not too bloody, but a little bit. And it's so tender and it got so much flavor. I love pigeon. You never have pigeon?
Never.
You gotta come to the restaurant and get pigeon, Thierry.
How do you prepare pigeon?
Well, I have in this book, I think we have it in the book. I love it, these recipes that I made. I think we... We just roast the pigeon and we make a nice simple jus. And what I like to do, I take the legs out of the pigeon, because when you do a dish, you like to be complex and you like to do to have different flavor. Because different flavor on the dish, this is what makes the dish so nice. So I confit the legs of the pigeon, who give me one flavor. I confit the cabbage, who give me another flavor. And I have the flavor on the pigeon, plus at the end I have the jus, who just brings everything back. So, you know, I have a perfect picture, yeah.
Now, one of your signature dishes is crab cake with light mustard sauce. Would you describe that for us?
Well, you know, I went to Maryland one day and I have a crab cake there. And it was good, but it was too heavy and too... So I came back to the restaurant and I said, what am I going to do? I got to come up with something. I want to do a crab cake, but I don't want to do a crab cake like this. And then one day came. I said, I got it. And then I make a mousse. I make a mousse with shrimp. It was very light. And I take this mousse and I mix it up with crab. And I season it with Tabasco because I want to make it a little spicy, mustard. And I put Worcestershire sauce. And that give me really a nice flavor. And then when I cook my crab cake rise because the mousse puff. And when you eat it, it's very light and very fluffy. And you have the flavor of the mousse, plus you have the flavor of the crab. It's really a wonderful dish.
You do price fix,
yes,
meals at your restaurant, Le Becfin. Why do you like working that way with the price fix idea, fixed price?
Well, I do. I started a fixed price because I don't know if you remember when I opened my first restaurant, I only have 9 tables. And it was a small restaurant.
Very small. It was like 37 people.
Yeah,
that
was 37 people. You're absolutely right. So if I have not done a fixed price, if I have done a menu à la carte and I have customer coming and eating one main course, I would have been out of business in 6 months. I would have never made it. The fixed price keep me in business. And then when I bought I moved to my new location, the restaurant was not big. I mean, I only see 55 at Le Becfin. It's not a big restaurant, 60 people. And I hesitated and I debated and I said, I go à la carte or I go fixed price. And, you know, fixed price was very successful. I have done it for 13 years. People were used to it. So I said, I'm going to continue to do the fixed price. That's what I continued to do it on a new location. I didn't change it.
So how many courses do you like to serve?
So I serve an appetizer, then a fish course, then a main course, then the salad, then the cheese, or cheese, or both if people want, no matter. Then we have a sorbet. Then we have the dessert card. Then we have coffee. Then we have the petit four.
That's a lot.
But of course it's a lot. It's an occasion. You go there, not... You know, we are an occasion. You come to Le Bec for an engagement, divorce.
People come there to celebrate a divorce?
Yes. For a birthday, for an anniversary. We are on occasion. We are a restaurant for people who make a business deal. That's what we are here for.
You talk about the kind of pressures that chefs have to deal with. What are the worst pressures that you have to deal with?
Pressure. Terry, the pressure on my business is so high, you have no idea. It's like, first of all, the pressure is high because you have to make sure when we have a menu, we have so much things to do, everything is ready, and it's ready by 6 o'clock. So the pressure is there to push these people to perform because, me, I work fast, but it's me. I can't do by myself what 4 guys are doing it. But now on this world, it's not the same anymore. You know, now it takes me 4 people to remplace what I used to do. Now when you have one person working because they're slow and they don't perform at the speed of the work, this is pressure. This is a lot of pressure. So all this pressure developed. Then the tension, when the customer comes, a lot of tension because, you know, if you have 2 sitting like we have to make sure we can turn over the table, not rushing the customer. Everything has to be nice. Everything has to be smooth. Sometimes it's crazy in the kitchen, but that's the nature of the business. If you cannot take the pressure of the kitchen, stay out of the kitchen because you're not going to be able to do this business because it's a lot of pressure in this business.
My guest is Chef Georges Perrier, founder of the restaurant Le Bec Fin in Philadelphia. He's just completed his first cookbook called Le Bec Fin Recipes. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with French chef Georges Perrier, author of the new cookbook, Le Bec Fin Recipes, named after his renowned restaurant in Philadelphia. Did you resist it initially when Americans started eating more lean food? Did you see it as a rejection of your cuisine?
No, because, it came from me, too, because I changed. Because, cooking is much like an artist to paint. If you take an impressionist, he has a couple of periods. If you take Picasso, he has the first period, the second period, and the third period. And because you evaluate and you change and you get older, and things change, you want to do different things. It's like a painting. And me with my food is exactly the same. I change. That was my first period. Then after I have my second period, my third period. Now my third period is to really find that the lightness and the flavor. That's what I want. But it has to be light, and flavor.
So tell me what kind of sauces you've substituted for the rich butter and cream sauces that you don't prepare anymore.
You see what, if I do a sauce, for example. If I do a beurre blanc and I put the cream. Now I do a beurre blanc. Let's say that I do a beurre blanc. I don't put any cream. I reduce less. I put no cream, but I gotta put something. I need a blender, so I put butter. A little bit of butter, but not too much. And we blend the sauce on the blender. So the sauce get a lot of air and get lighter. And then I'm not afraid to put water. If I need water, if I feel the sauce need water, I put water. I do a lot of sauce with chicken stock. Not even fish stock, because I see when fish stock, when it reduce, give a bad flavor. So I won't get my flavor from the chicken stock because it's more neutral. So you see, everything is reverse, everything is changed.
Is the cooking in France lighter now, too?
Oh, yes, definitely, yeah. Mm. Yeah, because we have the revolution, I will say 10 years ago, what we call Nouvelle Cuisine, where the portions were small, there were nothing to eat. That work in France, that would have never worked in the United States. You know, people in the United States want to have something on the plate. If there's nothing on the plate, they're not going to be happy.
That's right. Yeah, Americans are used to big portions.
They're used to nice portions, and they like to eat.
My guest is Georges Perrier, one of America's most famous chefs, owner of Le Bec Fin restaurant in Philadelphia, and now author of the new book, Georges Perrier, Le Bec Fin Recipes. Tell me a dish that you came up with yourself and how you came up with it.
Dish I came up with myself. No, I came up with that. I was thinking that I want to do something with salmon, for example. This is fresh salmon.
Oh, salmon, yeah.
Fresh salmon. Mm-hmm. So I said, what am I going to do with salmon? I've done many things with salmon. I smoked the salmon this summer, lightly smoke, and I do that. And I said, I really want to come with something different. So, and then the other day I was sitting in my car, and it's just a dime to me. I said, I think I got it. I'm going to cook carrots, slice carrots, very pretty. I'm going to make it very pretty. And I'm going to saute the carrot. And I'm not going to caramelize the carrot or give a special. I don't want the carrot caramelized. I want the carrot cooked nice. And I put a little chicken stock to bring back all the flavor. And I'm going to perfume this carrot with fresh thyme. Because I think fresh thyme will bring the flavor of the carrots. Then I'm going to take my saumon. And I'm going to cook the saumon de teflon pen. Then I get my feather. And I was thinking, what I'm going to put around that saumon to make a sauce, a nice sauce. Then I came up with this idea to do a very light sauce with lemon. I'm going to reduce lemon. I'm going to put a little fish stock and the jus de moule to get some flavor. And no cream. I don't want cream. So I'm going to reduce it. I'm going to put butter. And I said, well, that's nice, but I want still another flavor. I said, I'm looking for something who can bring back this old dish. And I came up with just a little bit of sesame oil on the sauce to bring back everything. That's it. I got my dish. So I got my carrots to give me a flavor. I got my saumon. I'm going to get a flavor. Plus, I'm going to get my sauce with lemon because I got the tart in here who bring back everything. And then a little bit of sesame oil on the sauce will break everything and makes this dish really a nice dish.
Sounds good.
You see?
Yeah. have you ever eaten in fast food restaurants just to see what they're
yes,
like?
Yes, I eat. I have a daughter, I mean, who's 23, and she took me to McDonald's, so I eat at McDonald's like everybody else, and Burger King, and junk food, and everything. I have tasted everything. I have, since my daughter now is 23 years old, I have not put my foot on a McDonald's or Burger King in maybe 15 years or 16 years. But I would not say one day I will eat an hamburger. I eat everything because it's food, you know, and if it's done well, it's good.
What are some of the things you see happening now in the food world, like new food tastes, new food trends that you either like or don't like?
Well, I like everything because, you know, the food in this country, I mean, we are in the business. What you think you know today and what you think you do today, somebody is going to do better tomorrow because there is so much talent in this country. And it all started in California. I always believe when you are in the country where is wine, you have great chef, like in Lyon, because we have the wine. Food and wine goes together. So the trend of food who came from California would change California completely over with the influence of the Mexican food, whatever you want to put on it. But of course, you have all these talents. You know, in New York, at great restaurants. You can go to Washington, you have great restaurants. It's constantly moving, and you have great American chefs who are pushing so hard because they're very talented. You know, for many years, and then they develop, and they develop, and develop. Now, let me tell you, the level of the food industry in this country is higher than it is in France.
Georges Perrier is the author of the new cookbook, Le Bec Fin Recipes, named after his 5-star restaurant in Philadelphia, Le Bec Fin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.